My name's Matthew Byrne. I'm the president of the Cincinnati Lawyers Chapter, and I want to echo Ben's comments in welcoming you all here and thanking you for coming. And also, again, I want to echo Ben as well in thanking the national organization, especially Lisa Ezell and Kate Fugate, in all of the work and assistance they've provided for this event. So I'm particularly happy to introduce this panel on Janus versus AFSCME, as I practice employment law at Jackson Lewis. I'm aware of the significance of this, the issues that are currently before the Supreme Court in the Janus case, which in particular could potentially have a very significant practical effect, not just a constitutional law effect, but a very practical effect here in Ohio. So with that said, I want to introduce you to our panelists and our moderator. Our moderator, Robert Ault, is president and CEO of the Buckeye Institute, where he also serves on the Board of Trustees. The Buckeye Institute has experienced exponential growth under Mr. Ault's leadership in the last few years. He founded the Institute's Economic Research Center and a Legal Center. Mr. Ault is a nationally recognized scholar with expertise in legal policy, including criminal justice, national security, and constitutional law. Prior to serving at the Buckeye Institute, Mr. Ault was director of the Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, where he worked under former Attorney General Ed Meese. His writings have appeared in the Washington Times, the New York Post, SCOTUS Blog, and elsewhere. He's a longtime contributor to National Review, and he's testified before Congress many times, including as part of the confirmation process for Justice Elena Kagan. He serves on the Board of Trustees of multiple organizations, including here in Ohio, the Board of Advisors of the Ashbrook Center at Ashland University. Mr. Ault has taught classes in multiple subjects at Ashland University and at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. Mr. Ault earned his undergraduate degree from Azusa Pacific University and his law degree from the University of Chicago Law School. He then clerked for Judge Alice Batchelder on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. Our first panelist, William L. Messenger, is a staff attorney at the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, where he spent his legal career. Mr. Messenger earned his undergraduate degree from Ohio University and his law degree from George Washington University. During his time at the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, Mr. Messenger has worked on many prominent labor law cases, including the NLRB's Dana Corporation decision. He argued for the petitioners before the Supreme Court in Harris versus Quinn. Also, and most relevant to our discussion today, Mr. Messenger argued before the Supreme Court just a few weeks ago in the Janus versus AFSCME case on behalf of the petitioner, Mr. Janus. Mr. Messenger has also published articles on labor law topics, including in the Federalist Society's journal Engage. Our second panelist, Camille Bear, is the Carter C. Kissel Professor of Law at the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law, where I must say she was my employment law professor. Professor Bear earned her undergraduate degree from Kansas State University and her law degree from the University of Kansas, where she was editor-in-chief of the Kansas Law Review and was elected Order of the Coif. After law school, Professor Bear clerked for Judge James K. Logan of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit, and then practiced labor and employment law representing management at Spencer, Fain, Britt & Brown in Kansas City, Missouri. Professor Bear has published numerous academic articles on employment discrimination, sexual harassment, employee privacy, and alternative dispute resolution. She's also served as Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at the Moritz College of Law. Professor Bear will, broadly speaking, present the union's position in the Janus versus AFSCME case. So thank you all for joining us. And I just want to mention there was a comment about noise earlier. If there continues to be a problem with noise from the back, please speak up. We want to make sure all of you can hear. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt, for that kind introduction. So I'm going to go ahead as the moderator and give you a brief background on the case so that Bill and Professor Hubert can jump right in. Janus versus AFSCME is one of the most watched cases before the Supreme Court this term, but for many observers, it brings to mind the wisdom of that great legal commentator, Yogi Berra. It's deja vu all over again. This is the second time the Supreme Court has heard the same issue in just the past 2 years, namely whether the decision in Abood versus Detroit Board of Education regarding whether a state can compel public employees to pay a union to engage in collective bargaining activity as a condition of employment should be overruled. By way of brief background, the National Labor Relations Act leaves the regulation of state and local governments to employment issues to the states. Accordingly, states may choose to permit or prohibit agency fee arrangements for public employees. Under an agency fee arrangement, a public employee who chooses not to become a member of a union would nonetheless be required to pay for the cost of chargeable, putatively non-political activities as a condition of employment. This is the law in 22 states, plus two more that permit agency fees for some, but not all, public employees. By contrast, right-to-work laws prohibit conditioning employment on paying agency fees or union dues. 26 states prohibit agency fees or public sector collective bargaining completely, or for public sector collective bargaining completely. In 1977, the Supreme Court in Abood versus Detroit Board of Education upheld compulsory agency fee arrangements to fund collective bargaining, contract administration, and grievance adjustment activities for public sector employees against a First Amendment challenge. The court acknowledged the government interest put forward included allowing for a single bargaining representative, promoting labor peace, and avoiding the free rider problem, the latter being the idea that those workers who are not paying agency fees will nonetheless benefit from the contracts negotiated by the unions and will therefore not be paying their proportional share of representation. But the court found that the use of compulsory funds for political or ideological activities outside of collective bargaining would violate the First Amendment. In recent years, the Supreme Court has expressed increasing skepticism to the decision in Abood. In Knox versus SEIU back in 2012, the court departed from the standard of review in Abood, applying at least exacting scrutiny to a special assessment made by a union, and expressly questioned the continuing vitality of Abood. These questions from the court became more pronounced 2 years later in Harris versus Quinn, in which the court announced six reasons why the Abood court's reasoning was questionable. 2 years later, in 2016, the Supreme Court heard the case of Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association, our Yogi Berra case, which argued that the split between political and non-political speech in Abood doesn't work because collective bargaining speech engaged in by unions is political speech, and compulsory agency fees therefore violate the First Amendment. Oral arguments were heard in January 2016, but as we all know, in February 2016, Justice Scalia passed away. The court then deadlocked 4-4 on the decision. That brings us to the current case. Mark Janis works for the Illinois Department of Healthcare and Family Services. As a condition of employment, he must pay an agency fee to the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. He challenges that requirement as a violation of his First Amendment right not to fund collective bargaining speech. With this brief introduction to the case, please join me in welcoming Bill Messenger, who will offer the appellant's position.
Thank you, Robert, and thank you to the Federal Society for giving me the opportunity to speak today and also for the opportunity to come back to Ohio. It's good to be home. So, briefly summarized, the argument against agency fees is that the government is forcing individuals to pay an advocacy group to lobby the government. Because in the public sector, collective bargaining is indistinguishable from lobbying. Collective bargaining in the public sector involves an advocacy group, a union, meeting and speaking with public state officials in an attempt to influence those officials as to the public policies they enact. And many of the policies that they're discussing during these bargaining sessions are of great political and budgetary import. So overall, it's relatively indistinguishable from lobbying. And if the First Amendment prohibits anything, it prohibits the government from dictating who speaks for individuals in their relations with the government. Now, the First Amendment does so not only because it obviously protects the freedom of speech, but the First Amendment also protects the right to petition government for a redress of grievances. And what that usually means is the right to speak to government officials in an attempt to influence their policies. And so the government very much infringes. Can't hear? Okay. So the argument in Janis is that the agency fees infringe upon that right of speech and the right to petition by the government compelling individuals, public employees, to support a particular advocacy group's agenda before the government. Now, as Robert mentioned, the primary argument for agency fees adopted by the Supreme Court in Abood is the free rider argument. This is the argument that employees benefit from union advocacy, and therefore they should be forced to pay for it, or otherwise they're free riding on the union's speech and bargaining. But there's a few problems with this argument. And the primary one is that it's not the government's role to dictate what speech is in an individual's best interest. The First Amendment reserves that right to each individual to choose what speech and what advocacy groups best serve their purposes. And even if it was sort of something that the government could, you know, weigh in upon, you know, people can reasonably believe that union advocacy is not in their best interest. Some employees may disagree with positions the union takes at the bargaining table or believe it's too militant or too leftist. On the other hand, there may be employees who agree with the union's position, but agree the union's or believe the union's ineffective and isn't worthy of their financial support. It's the same reasons that all of us and every other individual chooses whether or not to support an advocacy group. You either disagree with it, or even if you don't disagree with it, you might just think it's not worth your money. And these are decisions that the First Amendment prohibits the government from second-guessing, as it's the individual's right to choose exactly what advocacy they believe benefits them and is worthy of their support. Now, unions often claim that they're different from other advocacy groups and that the government requires that they represent individual employees in collective bargaining, and therefore individuals who, it's just some, this burden of exclusive representation is a burden imposed upon unions for which the union deserves compensation. But we submit in Janus and in other cases that the opposite is true. Exclusive representation is not something that the government imposes on unions. It's something unions voluntarily seek and covet. And the reason they do so is exclusive representative authority is an incredibly valuable power to a union. This gives the union the authority to speak for everyone in the bargaining unit, whether the individual wants it or not. It also compels the government to listen to the union, and only that union and no other advocacy group, on certain topics, and to not change government policies until the government speaks with the union in good faith about those policies. All of these things greatly increase the union's leverage to increase its agenda and also help the union retain and recruit members, because individual employees, quite frankly, are more apt to join a union that controls their employment partially than a union that does not. And in many cases, unions bargain for things that help them recruit members, such as dues deduction agreements and other aspects of collective bargaining agreements that assist in that endeavor. So the notion that exclusive representation is a burden imposed on unions for which they deserve compensation, I submit, doesn't hold up. Union complaints about exclusive representation are somewhat similar to, you know, Napoleon complaining about the weight of the crown that he seized and placed upon his own head. It's not a burden, but it's a power. And if anything, exclusive representative authority undercuts the free rider argument, because exclusive representative authority strips an individual employee of their right to speak and contract for themselves and transfers their right to speak and contract to the union, even if that individual dissents from that union advocacy. So these individuals who dissent from the union are not in fact free riders, as they're sometimes pejoratively called. They're in fact forced riders, as the government is forcing them to accept an advocate against their will that they may not wish to support. And so in all, the position of Janus is that unions should be treated just like any other advocacy group. Individuals can choose to join and support if they wish, but individuals also have the right not to join and support that advocacy group, and the union should be treated as voluntary advocacy groups just like any other organization. As you can imagine, Janus, there's a lot of technical legal arguments that actually the case will probably hinge upon, standard of review, strict scrutiny, but we can get into those to the extent people are interested. But that's just sort of in a nutshell, the First Amendment argument and the argument against the free rider rationale for forced fees.
So probably not surprisingly, I have a slightly different perspective on both the Abood case and the Janus case. So in some sense, the what's going to happen in the case is not really much mystery because the deja vu all over again, right? We know how 8 members of the Supreme Court have already voted. And there's probably not much doubt about how the 9th member of the Supreme Court is going to vote. But I think what's sort of important is to think about sort of the real issue here. Because the real issue here is not to protect employees against, to protect employees' speech or forced speech. The real issue here is the desire to hurt unions and to make unions less effective. Because if public sector employees can't band together in unions, then effectively employers of public sector employers, right, won't have to worry as much about unions. So why are agency fees important? Because the important work that unions do on behalf of employees is not free. Because unions need funding in order to be able to carry out activities on behalf of public sector employees. Activities that they are mandated to do, right, to bargain over mandatory terms and conditions of employment, to represent employees in grievance procedures, right? They are required to do that. Whether the burden of exclusive representation is a burden or not, the duty of fair representation is very real. That is, whether people pay fees to unions or whether they join a union, the union has the obligation to treat those employees just like union members. So I obviously don't think unions are an advocacy group. I think unions are organizations that exist in order to protect employees, to allow employees to operate collectively with respect to their employer. And I think what's important is to recognize that the issue here isn't whether unions can use agency fees to engage in political activity. We already know the answer to that. Abood made clear that they can't. What the question is whether agency fees can be used for contract negotiation, for contract administration, including processes and grievances. Abood's been the established law for 41 years, right? The issues haven't changed. The Constitution hasn't changed. Only the composition of the court has changed. The court in Abood recognized the important reasons that agency fee agreements exist, the costs borne by unions in representing employees and administering contracts and pursuing grievances. Agency fee agreements provide unions with the resources they need to perform, again, their mandated duties, and to avoid, right, free riders, right? Employees who benefit regardless of whether they pay fees. Right? And it's not just that they benefit with respect to contract administration, although I doubt the employees who don't want to pay agency fees also want to give back the wage increases they get because of negotiated agreements. But it's also contract enforcement, right? That is, employees who don't pay agency fees have every right to be treated the same way as other employees with respect to grievances processes. So the court in Abood recognized that agency fees implicate First Amendment rights. But what the court also recognized is that the government interest in labor peace and contributing to labor relations, right, justified the intrusion on First Amendment rights. So the court in Abood rejected precisely the arguments that are being made now and precisely the argument that everything a union does in the public sector is political. In some sense, there's something very ironic about reliance on First Amendment rights of employees to justify invalidating union fees. This isn't a situation in which the law in the last 41 years has become more protective of employees' free speech rights. It's exactly the opposite. The law generally does not protect very much the First Amendment rights of employees. So in the cases from Connick versus Myers to Garcetti, right, the court has limited the rights of employees to speak when governmental interests, even in efficiency and productivity, are involved. So it's curious that while employees have relatively little right to speak, that now their right not to speak is being given special protection. So any any issue about whether this is an attempt to weaken unions, I think, is cleared up by the argument made in front of the U.S. Supreme Court a couple of weeks ago. I wasn't there, as you were, but I had read the transcript. And basically, sort of the question that was arose was, well, so when employees speak generally, individual employees speak about their terms and conditions of employment, are they protected? And the answer was, oh, no, that isn't protected. And the question answer was why, when unions do it, it's all of a sudden, right, First Amendment speech. And the answer was, well, it's an issue of scale. And then the question was, well, what if a bunch of employees get together and want to speak? And the answer was, maybe not. And ultimately, the question answer was that the speech was not protected because, quote, it's taking place between a third-party organization, a union, and the government. This isn't an issue of scale. This is an issue of not protecting unions. So what I think is particularly important to realize, right, is that, again, an employee who decides not to pay for speech, right, not to pay agency fees, Freudian slip perhaps, employees who don't want to pay for the agency fees, and if this case comes down the way it's likely to, they won't have to. Again, still have all of the rights that the duty of free representation provides to those employees. We didn't talk much about the effect of it, and maybe we can talk about that later, but I think one of the important issues to think about with respect to this is, will losing agency fees mean that unions will die? No. Will it hurt unions? Of course it will hurt unions. But there will always be people who support unions, even though they don't have to. I think it will mean that people, right, once they don't know they don't have to pay for the services the union has to give them in any event, some of them will stop paying, right? Some of them will not join the union. But there will always be people who will support the union, who recognize that what unions provide are valuable, and that they need to pay for it.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and give 2 minutes each for you to respond to what you've heard from the opposing side, beginning with Bill.
Just actually, I think the last point I found to be most on point is that if individual employees believe that the union representation, the union advocacy is worth supporting, there will be employees who support it. And that's what freedom of choice is ultimately about. And this also shows that agency fees are not necessary. A big question in the case has become, can agency fees satisfy constitutional scrutiny? Which really comes down to, are agency fees a least restrictive means for collective bargaining or narrowly tailored means? If unions will survive without agency fees, that proves that agency fees are not needed for exclusive representation or for collective bargaining, and therefore can't survive First Amendment scrutiny and the infringement they inflict upon employees. So ultimately, I think the fact that unions will survive, which I agree with, shows that why agency fees and this First Amendment infringement aren't necessary.
I do think there is an issue between whether they survive, which I think they will. I do think they will. When I talk about agency fees with my students, I analogize it to public radio, right? That is, there will always be people who support public radio, even though they could turn on the radio without it, right? They can listen without it. I'm one of those, right? Big surprise. But the issue is, right, if unions are going to survive and provide the services that they have been able to provide, right, they need the support, right? There is a reason why states have adopted, right, sort of agreements or enter into agreements with respect to agency fees, because it will weaken unions. And again, I think that's the purpose, is to weaken unions. But I think there's a difference between whether they survive and whether they thrive. And I think the issue, right, I do think agency fees are the less restrictive means to accomplish the purposes that they are there for, which is to have a strong partner with employers, right, in bargaining And in grievance arbitration, I think particularly in grievance arbitration. Again, those employees who don't want to pay still want the services of the union.
All right, I think this is a Federalist Society first. Both speakers were under time for both the presentation and the replies. It's never happened. And clearly, this was out of respect for this esteemed audience, because they want to hear your questions. And again, we keep to the Columbus rules with regard to questions. Questions are questions. No more, and the way you can tell, they're generally no more than three compound complex sentences in length, the last of which ends with a question mark. Your voice will oftentimes go up at the end of that, indicating that you're actually looking for a reply. As you all cue, I will take the moderator's privilege and toss out the first question. Based upon actually the back and forth that you had there, as well as Matt's introduction, this is a very big issue for Ohio, practically, when you think about it. We've got 320,000 public sector union workers or agency fee payers in Ohio. That makes us the sixth largest state in terms of public sector unionized employees. What will be the practical effect of a decision, presuming it comes down in favor of Mr. Janus in Ohio, one, and what, if anything, can we learn from other states that have gone right to work? How is that instructive or not? And I offer as a jump ball for both of you.
My sense is what we can learn is that there will be a decrease in both people, well, of course, people who are paying agency fees mostly are doing it because they don't want to join the union. So I assume most people paying agency fees rather than union dues will probably stop. I think the other effect that is likely to happen is that you will see a decrease in union membership. And part of it is a simply economic issue, which is as the agency fee payers stop paying and the union's obligations to represent continue, and again, not free, that you will see more people who make the decision about, am I going to join the union and pay union fees? I get all the same services no matter what. I think you will see people that will stop, will resign from the union and will stop paying, which will increase the cost of union dues, which will cause more people to resign from the union. So I think the answer is you'll see a decrease in union density in the public sector, but I don't think it will go away. And I think we've seen that in states that have gone to my students know this. I never use the term right to work without air quotes, because I actually don't think what is called right to work has anything to do with right to work. But that's the only time I'll use them. I promise I'll keep my hands down for the rest of the time. But states that have gone to that model, we've seen a decrease in union density.
I think the question of how much, you know, union density will decrease if Janus comes out the right way, it's very difficult to predict. And the reason is Wisconsin and Michigan both had other changes in their law in addition to the right to work. Wisconsin, for example, has recertification requirements for unions. So if they don't get recertified, the entire union is decertified. In Michigan, you had some payroll deduction bans. So looking at the most recent right to work states, it's hard to extrapolate. And of course, looking nationwide, it comes a lot down to culture. You know, the culture of workplaces in California may be different than upstate New York. But ultimately, from my perspective, exactly how many individuals choose to exercise their right to drop out of a union if Janus comes down the right way, it's besides the point. Ultimately, it's about individual freedom of choice. And to the extent unions thrive or fail, that simply reflects the marketplace of ideas. If unions do in fact fail after Janus or some do, that just shows that individual employees didn't support that union, didn't support its advocacy. And that's the way the First Amendment is supposed to operate, in that good ideas gain support, bad ideas drop support, and the same with organizations. So it remains to be seen exactly what happens with respect to union membership. The bigger thing that we're watching for, meaning the Right to Work Foundation and myself, is what some states will do in reaction to Janus. And in many cases, based upon experience in Harris, it will be to make life difficult for individuals to exercise their right not to support a union. So in Harris versus Quinn, the Supreme Court held it was unconstitutional for states to force Medicaid providers, who are not full-fledged public employees, to pay full union dues. So the hope, of course, is that the result in Janus will be more or less the same as the result in Harris, but applied to all public employees. Well, in the wake of Harris, many states did a couple interesting things. For example, Washington State, if you become a Medicaid provider, they'll still take union dues out of your Medicaid's payment, even though it's unconstitutional to do so, unless you object the way the union wants to. So the union takes your money unless you take the affirmative step of getting out of the union. A second thing we've seen are these checkoff restrictions, that if the union can get you to sign a card saying, I want to be a union member, I agree to pay union dues, there's a very narrow window for revoking that. It's usually about 10 or 15 days per year. And if you don't revoke during that yearly period, they take union dues for an entire another year, 100%. And so we saw a lot of that in Harris. And then after Harris, we also saw a lot of compulsory orientations. This is where the government requires Medicaid providers to attend 30-minute meetings with union organizers for the purpose of being sold on the union and convinced to sign membership cards and those dues deduction cards that I mentioned earlier that are valid for a year and are very difficult to get out of. And so these are all the things we saw states do in the wake of Harris. And we're starting to see them already do it preemptively in anticipation of Janus potentially coming out in Mr. Janus's favor. So as you can imagine, there'll probably be a great deal of litigation on that. But from my perspective, the real question is, what further roadblocks to employee freedom of choice will we see in the wake of Janus if it comes out successfully?
Well, what more cheerful way could we end in a room full of lawyers that the opening round than saying that there'll be ample litigation opportunities in the future? Mr. Smith, you have the mic.
Thank you. I'm Andrew Smith from Columbus. And this is a question for both panelists. The last 20 years or so, private sector unionization has fallen. Say we're 6 or 7% now, maybe lower. Same period of time, public sector unionization has been increasing, high 30s, I think it is. What are the legal and policy reasons behind those two different trajectories?
Well, in terms of the differences, I think, you know, the private sector reflects just the power of the free market. You know, if you're inefficient in the private sector, you go out of business. If you're inefficient in the public sector, well, you just raise taxes. So, you know, the government can't go out of business, you know, to a large degree. So I think that's what you see a lot of the difference between the public and private sectors. The public sector is usually a ratchet. As soon as the unions gain that exclusive representative power, except for when it comes to decertification, which is incredibly difficult to do, they're there permanently. In the private sector, companies come in and out of business, as I mentioned, and to the extent that unionization makes them inefficient and uncompetitive, they're more apt to go out of business. So I think that's one of the main differences you see for the density there.
I think there's also indications that private sector employers generally fight unions at a higher rate, that is, much try to keep them from, do a lot of things that end up violating the law in addition, right, to keep them from being union certified. And I think traditionally public sector employers have not been as antagonistic to unions.
Yes, I think that brings up a good point of another difference is the idea in the public sector is that you elect your own boss. So, you know, if you unionize Acme Corporation, as a union generally, you don't choose who runs Acme Corporation, unless the union trust fund basically, you know, controls it that way, but that's very unusual. In the public sector, of course, unions are very active in electing who their boss is, whether it's who's on the school board, who's the next governor, et cetera. And so I think that goes a lot towards the antagonism point made there, is that the government controls who's on the other, or the union controls who's on the other side of the table to some degree.
Next question.
Lee Strang from Toledo. I have a question which I mean to be parallel for both panelists. So Mr. Messenger, you are at a Federal Society conference. The previous panel talked about originalism. Is there, what do you think are the originalist arguments for the proposition that public sector employers can't condition employment on either membership in a union or payment of union dues? And then I view the parallel question for Professor Hebert being, you acknowledge that in First Amendment law, public sector employee First Amendment rights have been narrowed, so what would be the living constitutionalist argument for maintaining or expanding public sector union employees' First Amendment rights in this context?
Sure. So the originalist argument, you know, you could start with Thomas Jefferson's Virginia Statute for Religious Freedoms, which many people consider to be the precursor or the model for the First Amendment. And in that, you know, there's a line in there that to compel a man to make contributions for the propagation of opinions with which he disbelieves is sinful and tyrannical. That's quoted a lot, and I just misquoted it there, I'm sure, but that's more or less what it said. But there's also a part of the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom that actually said it was wrongful to condition public employment on individuals taking oaths or what an individual believes. And in that case, he was referring back to, you know, practices in England that if you didn't confirm your belief in the church, confirm your belief in the royalty, you were denied public employment. And so the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, ultimately in its operative text, actually made it illegal, you know, to condition a public job on someone's faith. And I submit that interpretation, you know, was brought within to the First Amendment because the idea of compulsory oaths, compulsory affiliation was quite offensive to the founders, which was reflected a lot in Justice Black, who many consider to be the first originalist, what he called justice in this country, who dissented in cases called Street and others, believing that Madison and Jefferson would have been very much opposed to that. And then also on a similar point, you know, you have Madison's opposition to factions. And of course, a faction is a small group of individuals usually coming together to advance their own interests against the general public interest as a whole. Now, what you have with exclusive union representatives is basically a government-created faction. Here, the government is declaring that all employees must support and be represented by this particular interest group, whether they like it or not. Now, if the founders had problems with voluntary factions and the problems that they caused, you know, to the democratic process, I submit they would be aghast at the idea of the government literally creating factions to support their particular agenda. So in a nutshell, that's the originalist argument. A lot of the briefing was actually in rejecting the other side's religious originalist argument, which somebody wants to hear about later. I'll get into, but I don't want to filibuster this question.
So I do have enough sense not to try to take on originalism in front of the Federalist Society. So I'll answer the other question, which I think was if you see increased protection in Janus, if Janus comes increased protection for public sector employees, free speech will it extend sort of to other contexts, right, where employees have free speech rights? I hope that was the question. That was at least the question I heard. That's the question I'm going to answer. and I think the answer is I can't see that happening. And you can tell from the oral arguments in front of the court that so both Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor sort of said, well, wait a minute, right? That is, if you recognize this, then of course you're going to recognize that employees have First Amendment rights when they speak about the terms and conditions of employment. And the answer was, no, they're not going to have those protections, right? So this is sort of curiously a big protection not to speak when it involves money, but not much protection for speech.
Next question.
Professor May, you had mentioned, I believe, that union leaders have a fiduciary duty to their members. And when I was school board president, I certainly understood that to be the case. But I didn't see it. I saw it theoretically, but not practically, as I saw that on the day I was running for re-election, a young woman went out to her car and then from the voting booth came back out and approached me, and she looked around and she said, I'm a teacher in the school, and I support what you're doing. Now, what I was doing was supporting the concept of merit pay as opposed to longevity pay, which the union didn't like. She felt that her speech was so chilled that she could not express that to her union or publicly. Don't you think that if Janus is, well, if Abood is overruled, that will enhance the free speech of members of unions to take different positions than the union leadership?
I honestly don't. So I think, right, so yes, there are probably employees who do not feel free to contradict their union, right? I believe that. But I don't think the issue of agency fees has much to do with free speech at all. So I don't know Mr. Janus, but I've read enough about him to indicate that he doesn't seem to have any problem speaking out against the union, right? That we know what his views are, right? And so the issue of paying fees for representation the union has to provide you and speaking out against your union, I think, are entirely different issues.
I think, you know, there could be some relation there in the sense that if unions actually have to earn their money, they could become more responsive, you know, to their members, and that such tactics, you know, wouldn't work if people could vote, you know, with their wallet with respect to the union. Because just think, if you're selling a product and people have to buy it, whether you like it or not, how are you going to treat your customers? Treat them any way you want, doesn't matter, they have to buy it. All of a sudden, if a union has to prove that it's worth its money, then the union may have to be more solicitous to individuals like the teacher that you referred to.
Hi. So I work for a state that is defending a right to work law against litigation against it. And one of the arguments that's come up is over the in the private employer context, I guess there's a choice about whether states are going to ban agency fees or allow the agency fees. And it was fascinating to me why Congress put that in law. And I guess there's like two theories that I could come up with when we were mooting the case. Was either Congress was thinking, hey, we don't know what the effect of these will be, maybe there will be more responsiveness if you don't have agency fees, we'll let the states figure it out, laboratories of federalism. Or maybe Congress thought, hey, it's probably not constitutional for us to do this, so we'll let the states do it because incorporation hasn't caught up to them yet with the First Amendment, which says Congress shall make no law. Do you have any idea like what it was, and is there data on this responsiveness theory that's been coming up about
I don't know if it relates to responsiveness. I think your question goes to Section 14B of the National Labor Relations Act. So that's the section that basically says states can enact right-to-work laws. And it sort of goes to the history. So after the National Labor Relations Act was passed, a bunch of states, I think it was a dozen or so, passed right-to-work laws. The Supreme Court held that was permissible. That wasn't preempted by the National Labor Relations Act. Then the Taft-Hartley Act came up in 1947. That's when it was passed, but it's, you know, considered before then. And they put in 14B basically to confirm that what the Supreme Court said was correct, that states can in fact do this. They have that leeway to legislate and create the right to work laws that are not preempted by the National Labor Relations Act. So that seems to be the legislative history there, if that's what you were asking.
Do we know what they were thinking in leaving that up to the states, I guess is the question.
I think it didn't necessarily come up in that order in terms of history. So the National Labor Relations Act came onto the scene, a very big sea change. You know, if you think labor laws are bad now, what the Wagner Act was incredibly, you know, one-sided, very much union-sided. Some states reacted with right-to-work laws, and then again, the Supreme Court, as I mentioned, upheld them. And I think in the Taft-Hartley Act, when they brought more balance back to the National Labor Relations Act, they just wanted to be explicit that, yes, this is something that states can do. I don't know if there was any greater thinking or legislative history besides that, Jimmy.
Well, I, again, not surprisingly, have a different take on the relative merits of the Wagner Act and the Taft-Hartley Act, but I don't disagree with sort of the way in which that came about, which is the confirmation that states could, in fact, adopt such laws.
This is for Professor Hebert. I have an analogy, and I'd like to know at the end of it whether you would be comfortable with what was happening to you as a non-member. Costco and the village of Worthington negotiate a contract, and under the contract, Costco says that all village citizens can shop at Costco and enjoy the benefits of Costco pricing and other amenities. The villagers who wish can become members, but must pay full Costco dues. The villagers who do not wish can remain non-members and still shop and must pay what we'll call agency fees. Is it right to force non-village members who choose not to become members to pay the Costco agency fee dues? And are they free riders if they don't? And if you were one of those villagers who said, where'd this come from? I don't care about shopping at Costco. I don't care what the deal was between Costco and the village. How would you feel?
Well, so it's only fair, by the way, because I'm a law professor and I torment my students with hypotheticals all the time. So it's only fair that I have to respond to one. But the way I'm going to respond is, so we've been talking about forcing people to do things, but you do understand that unions only become the exclusive representative when they are elected by the majority of the members in the bargaining unit, right? So there are many things that I might not prefer as a minority voter, right? That is somebody who lost. I can think of a lot of things that I might not prefer as someone who voted and lost. But, sorry. But I'm not really sorry. But the answer is that this is what a majority has, right? When the union is certified as the exclusive bargaining agent, it's because they won the election, right? And so I was trying to concentrate on the hypo while I was still trying to sort of think about how I was going to answer it, which is always difficult, right? But if a situation, right, in which, would I like it? Probably not, but am I getting the services, right? So I guess the other answer is, should I be able to get all the services of shopping at Costco if I wanted to do that, right, without any of the costs of doing so, right? I think of it more as, like, do I get to ask my own hypo, right? So I think of it more as services that are provided, right, to us as citizens, and what if I think I don't like those services, I don't want to pay for those services, but I get them anyway? And the answer is, we are required to provide service, pay for services that we benefit from. And again, this is not sort of, you know, sort of the union sort of descending from on high to say we have to do these things. These are people who have voted for the union. They may have lost. They may not have wanted the union, but that's kind of the way majority rule works.
I agree that is the way majority rule works, but of course the purpose of the First Amendment is to protect individual rights from majority rule. I mean, that's the key concept. You know, it doesn't matter if 99%, you know, of the country is in favor of abortion, I still have a First Amendment right to speak against it. So the concept of majority rule, the tyranny of the majority, you know, should suppress each individual's right to choose, you know, what advocacy, what speech they wish to support. I submit just doesn't have any bearing under the First Amendment. And then even beyond the First Amendment, as a practical matter, you know, the vast majority of individual employees have never voted on whether they want the union that represents them. A study was done by James Shirk at the Heritage Foundation that found that 94%, I believe it was over 90%, of all private sector employees have never once voted on the union that represents them. And the reason is that once a union comes into power, once it wins the election once, or even not an election, a so-called card check where the union collects enough cards, the union's there permanently unless and until employees can somehow band together to decertify during very narrow window periods, which is exceedingly difficult to do. So there's places in this nation that have not had an election for decades as to whether or not they want the union to represent them. And my understanding is based on studies from certain areas of the public sector, it's even worse in the public sector, that there was one vote, one time. So even to the extent majority rule really has any bearing, you know, in the First Amendment context, which I submit it doesn't, here, for large portions of employees, there's never even been a majority choice as to whether or not they want that union.
So I do agree on his abortion analogy, right? You have every right to speak. And Mr. Janus has every right to speak against the union. He just may have an obligation, or they think he have an obligation to pay for the services that the union provides.
Because we got a late start, we do have a few more minutes if anyone else wanted to ask a question. The queue is open. So I will filibuster here for a second to see if we have any more, or if you've been beaten into submission. Well, let me go ahead and give each of you up to 2 minutes to give your closing argument.
Don't necessarily have a closing argument. I imagine, you know, it's just, we'll find out in May and June, you know, what the Supreme Court does. And then I guess, discuss after that, you know, what its effects are. Hopefully it'll be joyful discussions, but, you know, you never count your chickens. And so, you know, the case is submitted. As Robert mentioned, this is basically the third time they've heard it. And I think this time, you know, they'll decide it and we'll go from there.
So I definitely don't have a closing argument, although I also don't think there's much question about how the case is going to come out. Like I said, we know how eight of the justices voted, even if we can't guess how each of them voted, although I bet I could guess. But right, the answer is, I think this is going to happen, right? And so then the answer is, what are the results? What are the actual effects afterwards?
Excellent. Please join me in thanking our panelists.